Welcome to another episode of the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show Nikhil Varma to discuss data tokenization. Nikhil is an associate professor at Ramapo College in New Jersey and technology lead for the Algorand Foundation in India. Nikhil also serves as the chair of the blockchain work group at the Center of Excellence at The Digital Economist, where he leads initiatives at the forefront of blockchain technology and digital economics. Let's talk about all things data tokenization. Nikhil, welcome back to the show.
It's nice to be back, Alec and Jack.
Yeah, it's exciting to have you back. Last time we had you on to discuss supply chains. And when people talk about blockchain, the main use case I think they use outside of crypto is supply chains. And that was a fascinating episode. I learned a lot. It was one of our most popular episodes. So we thought we have to get you back. And today we're talking about data tokenization. So I'm really excited for this one. I think we're going to learn a lot.
I hope I'm able to provide good insights today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure you will, Dr. Varma. I mean, why don't we start, you know, with a basic definition, because this term data tokenization, it's something that I think has become more popular in the last couple of years, maybe. And at first glance, you know, it might not be clear exactly what we're talking about. So when people hear tokenization, a bunch of things come to mind, most of it to do with crypto speculation and, you know, NFTs, for example. And NFTs, we have data associated with them, right? Typically, if it's an image type NFT, you have like a JPEG famously associated with that. But I think data tokenization means something quite different, right? So what is your definition of that?
Sure. So before I get into data tokenization, just kind of briefly, what exactly tokenization is and what tokenization serves. The idea of tokenizing something, and especially in the context of blockchain, is to be able to provide it a digital identity, to be able to kind of play with it, to be able to manage things, right? And then there are other things like, you know, you have something which is a fungible tokenization or a non-fungible or a unique tokenization. Now, once it becomes a tokenized asset in the blockchain, we could do different kinds of business processes. And in that same vein, when we have data, okay, now what exactly is data going to be serving here, right? Is data something which is going to eventually lead to something? Yeah. And now generally, the data tokenization term that I have used is in the context of data which is going to be used to develop something like a carbon credit. So if I have some kind of a mechanism to be able to trace data streams which result in generating carbon credits, then that data stream that I am getting on a regular basis and securing in the blockchain, I can tokenize it and I can preserve it as an asset. So that's essentially what data tokenization is in the context of what I'm talking about.
Okay, got it. Yeah, that makes sense. So just to kind of slow things down a little bit then. So we understand the basic idea of tokenization in general. Then you mentioned things like carbon credits. So is the idea here to take things that aren't currently in a tokenized form that are more or less abstract, right? Like something like a carbon credit, or I'm sure you have other examples, and then to give it the properties of tokens such that they can be traded and transferred, or am I missing anything there? Is that the kind of core principle we're getting at?
That's exactly the principle behind tokenization. So tokenization gives it an identity, the structure, right? And then it becomes that mechanism, that is the mechanism with which you are able to, which that you can share with someone, that you can, you know, hold with someone as an asset, and then kind of have some kind of a financial transaction around it. I'll give you another example. Maybe the carbon credit is a bit abstract. Assume that I have my healthcare data. Yeah. Now my healthcare data is something that I can share with a medical research institution, and a medical research institution would provide me some incentives for that. Yeah. Now, this has been done for quite some time. And then what is the X factor that blockchain brings in? What is the delta that blockchain would bring in? Is I tokenize my data now. Yeah. Now I tokenize my data, and that tokenized data that I have, I will only give access to certain people who have signed some kind of an economic arrangement with me for that data, economic or could be any other arrangement, right? So maybe I'm just lending my data to innovation, right? And if that innovation happens, maybe there would be a fractional ownership in that innovation that I could possibly have, you know, just to kind of show the connect out the far-reaching effect of tokenization. Because if we just kind of sharing data, we will not be able to get all these different functionalities that we're talking about, right? So efficiency, financial transaction, having a complete visibility of the impact, all these things can happen with data tokenization.
Okay, that's useful to know, because when most people talk about tokenization right now, they think of value exchange. They think of either, like I say, the cryptocurrencies of the world or this big buzzword right now, real world assets and getting all assets on chain, right? And when I think of something that's tangible and real, like a building, I can very easily understand if I tokenize that, I can split that up, I can represent ownership, and everything comes down to ownership. But what you're saying there is I also want to have assigned some value to, you know, the data, like my healthcare data, for example, and also represent ownership and access rights to that data. What's the value for the end user in that example you gave? Say I have healthcare data, I tokenize it, I can control access, sure, but I could do that with an Excel file as well. What's the value in tokenizing it on a blockchain, for example?
Well, tokenization gives it, you know, it becomes more efficient. It's much more easier to share, right? It can be integrated to different kinds of systems, right? If I'm an architect, I've designed a house design. Yeah. Yeah, I can share my design with a password protected design with someone. Yeah. But how can I protect it? Right. How can I protect it? And how can I actually be incentivized or paid when it is used? Right. So essentially, it's, you know, a smart contract wrapped around this whole token can actually go and do business for me. Like, you know, suppose I'm a 3D artist. I tokenize my data and I say, yeah, you can print my artwork into any 3D printer of the world as long as you pay me, right? And then the smart contract has the ability to unlock it when the payment happens, and that gets integrated to a 3D printer. You get me? So yeah, data tokenization through blockchain protects your asset, also brings in efficiency also, and the economic mobility that kind of is caused because of the tokenization is far outreaching than any Web2 system, in my opinion.
I get that. So that actually makes a lot of sense. So it's not the data itself that's necessarily changing from the Web2 to Web3 model that you're talking about. It's all the utility around it. So the example you gave there is like, I think uniqueness is quite an important thing, right? I can prove that this data hasn't been tampered with, for example. So I like the healthcare example, because I think it's so universal to everyone around the world. They always understand like the value of having accurate and up-to-date healthcare data, but it's also very private and you don't want anyone to be able to access it. So I imagine like we have a problem with the NHS. I talk about it all the time here in the UK, where data isn't very shareable and it's very personal. I want it for myself. So what I'm imagining in this model you're talking about is I could potentially have my healthcare data on my mobile device, you know, personal to me. There's a reference to it on the blockchain or something like this that's been signed off by a medical professional to know that it has been verified. It has been verified. And then I can share it on whatever basis I want in like a peer-to-peer interaction. And they can reference that on the blockchain. Is that's one of the utilities, I guess. That's quite a cool thing to think about in this model.
Yeah. And there is one more aspect. So this is a very transactional approach that we are seeing. Now, the other aspect that, you know, which I've kind of written in one of my papers is talking about this data. You know, it's like these immovable assets, illiquid assets that we have, right? This data can sometimes be an illiquid asset. And that's where the example of carbon credit comes into play, right? Now, the data, which is kind of a streaming data, suppose I am going to generate carbon credit from a biodigester, yeah? And I have the amount of gas that is being consumed or is being produced by the biodigester through a meter, yeah? And that data is being stored in some kind of a system, which the data is hashed in the blockchain to be able to preserve its integrity. Now, this data actually to you and me means nothing, because I will probably tokenize it into a carbon credit in 6 months. Fine. Mm-hmm. But while it is sitting there, what if I could tokenize it? I could assign a future value to it and then send it out to a DeFi protocol for liquidity and trade. You see, this creates a completely different avenue, right? I mean, in the past, people used to have like, you know, I have a fixed asset, I have land. Okay, I'm going to be able to put my land on a reverse mortgage and I'll get some liquid for it. Yeah. essentially following the same kind of a logic here, that I am going to tokenize this data. So this data cannot be turned into a carbon credit unless until you de-tokenize it. Okay. And that token now becomes a liquid and with which I will be able to trade in DeFi protocols. So that's
interesting.
That's another angle to tokenization of data.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that I want to touch on. So I'm not sure I've fully grasped that last point about the kind of future value. But I think before we get to that, I want to build up a couple of other points here as well. So from what you've said so far and from some other things I've heard, one of the main incentives or reasons to tokenize data in this way. So let's, you know, maybe we go back to the healthcare example. There's a clear incentive for, you know, this, the transactional model that you were talking about, right? So example I've heard people talk a lot about is things like smart watches, right? Or fitness trackers, where you are a source of data yourself, your watches tracking things like heartbeat, steps, all that kind of stuff. And there's an incentive to share this for a reward with someone like an insurance provider or a medical research company who wants to use that data for, you know, their research purposes, for example. So I understand that the transactional element there. What is there any deeper reason than that for, say, us as end users to want to tokenize data? Or am I missing something? Is it purely in that kind of, before we get onto the kind of the future value and maybe get into almost like derivative type stuff, is that the core reason why someone would want to tokenize data that they own?
Yes, I mean, that is definitely one of the reasons, but let me give you some more aspects of that data. Okay, now, once you tokenize the data, you're giving it an identity, right? So it could be one or the other, right? I'm sharing my data, I get, say, 25 euros for that. Yeah, end of story. That data goes into a database, they clean it up, they take my name off and then whatever, and then they do some kind of a research with it. Okay, now picture this. I have a token, right? I share my token with you, with which you are going to do some kind of a research. Suppose you are doing an AI model training with that data set, right? What we could do is something that is called a sensitivity analysis. So using, and I have actually, this is a PhD research work that we are looking at currently, is what is the impact that this data is going to have on that AI engine? Okay. Now, not every data item would have an equal impact on the AI engine's learning ability. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, suppose I give a data set which actually made a big delta on the AI engine. Okay. We are using different kinds of models to be able to study that. Then that data set should have a different value as compared to the other data sets. You get me? If I give you data, you give me 25 euros for that. But my data was actually content rich and actually helped progress science. Okay. Why do I have to get $25 for that? I mean, I'm thinking from a pure capitalistic mindset, right? So I am giving you data, which is of high value. I should get 500 euros for that. But you know, you and I cannot make that determination. Let the machine make that determination. And since my data is tokenized, I am pretty sure that the subjectivity aspect is gone. The impact aspect will be measured and the identity aspect will be carried forward through multiple streams. You get me? In fact, suppose there is some kind of a data contribution where actually my piece of work is helping something happen. I'm always saying my piece, but anybody else's piece. I'm just using myself as an example here. I could get a bigger share in the pie as compared to somebody else. And that bigger share in the pie creates this whole avenue of less bias in data, which means now you as a person would collect data from a convenient sample, because people who don't know you will not give you data, because they'll be like, okay, I don't know this person, why would I share my data? But now if I'm a tokenized data set and I know that it is not a subjective aspect, it's not a known aspect, but the system is going to give me a fair price for my data set, I would go into that as a marketplace. So essentially, you have the ability to create a more open, more decentralized marketplace when you are tokenizing your data through a blockchain-based system.
That makes sense. I think it kind of links back to the art example you gave earlier on as well, the idea of like ownership and payback as it kind of gets pushed. You know, I create a piece of art, I tokenize it, and then I program into the token that if it gets sold later on down the line, any increase in profit, I get 10% of that as well. And that's a big thing that people do with NFTs to ensure that they have their work at the start. And if it turns out to be millions down the line, then they get a part of that. The idea of doing that with data is quite powerful, especially with this kind of AI revolution that's happening where, it's all based on the quality of the data, and lesser and lesser people want to share the data, and it's becoming illegal with GDPR compliance to have website crawlers and whatnot just pulling data from everywhere. So more and more we want fewer higher quality data than just spam data everywhere. But how do you incentivize people to actually share that data? Well, it's obviously monetization, but people don't trust AI companies, right? They don't trust where the data is going, how it's being used. But my question is it actually easy? Because we're talking about on-chain data and all this kind of stuff. But as soon as it goes to an AI model, that's off-chain. Is it easy to kind of ensure that link is maintained and there's traceability when it goes into the AI model?
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, to answer this question, straight line answer is absolutely, at this point of time, it is not possible. Right.
Okay.
But we'll have to build systems like that, right? One of the other arguments that is happening in the AI world is this whole idea of data coming in from all kinds of sources, whether it is, whether it was actually authentically sourced, or, it was just a data scraping solution which pulled all that information out. Now, if an AI engine is able to demonstrate that all the data that they used to train themselves were actually tokenized data that they procured from sources and they did have access to it, that gives it more credibility, right? Mm-hmm. So we could have, multiple kinds of AI engines evolving over a period of time. Many organizations have actually a corporate policy now. You cannot use an open AI system in the organization because that actually starts hindering with the customer's privacy. But there are many professors, many scholars, many researchers who have started training their own AI engines in their own space, right? And of course, that also kind of mandates you to be able to make sure that the data that you're training it with is actually a data that you're allowed to train it with. Mm. There's no way to check that. But I feel that there will be a time when we will have to tokenize data that would be the data that would be used for to train the AI should come in from a tokenized data source rather than just a data source.
Yeah, I think that the whole question of AI training, it's very much an open question and one, as you said, it's kind of very much unsolved right now. And that whole piece about a lot of companies saying you can't really use these LLMs because we're going to start disclosing our corporate data, our sensitive corporate data. And I've seen a lot of people also talking about the idea of local LLMs, which I think will be another interesting model, but it's still not quite this ideal hybrid that you're talking about, I think, where you can have these almost public growing large models, which provide the most value, they have the most data, they are the most performant of these AI models. But you also get these guarantees of the authenticity of which data is being used to train it and managing it in a private way. But as you said, I think a lot of that is definitely not a solved problem.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions, like recycling, at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show.
I want to come back to just the general idea of tokenizing data. And I think this, I see why we've moved on to thinking about this now, right? Because everyone has said for a long time, data is the new oil, right? It's one of the greatest commodities. But I've seen you, interestingly, you haven't called it oil. You've actually said, things like environmental data, they're actually more like fine wines, right? And that's because of the uniqueness, I think. So could you elaborate on that point? What is there that's unique and interesting about that kind of data that we can tokenize?
Sure. I mean, with my love for fine wine, of course, I had to kind of connect a few dots there. So one of the things that actually came to my mind was, what exactly constitutes a fine wine, right? How is wine actually fine? So it depends on what is the kind of grape that was used to cultivate it. How was the grape stored? right? What was the process of making that wine? Whether the casks were clean, whether they were, you know, they were transparent. If you know that this is a good brand, so of course there is a bit of a centralization when we talk about fine wine. So it's kind of an antithesis of what I'm trying to talk about here is decentralization. Mm-hmm. But the motivation was that, you know, you have to have a fine grape to make a fine wine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same thing, to be able to make a fine data, right? To be able to make data, because when I talk about environmental data is coming in from all places, right? When you look at an ESG report, it's everything, almost half of it is self-reported. When you look at a carbon credit, it's computed. It's not even reported. It's bizarre when you look at how people get carbon credits. They just go there, they do an audit, and they say, okay, yeah, you know what? We're going to give you 25,000 carbon credits. How did we get that? Oh, we just computed that. Or we just did a small section of, small population, subset of the population. And based on that, we are going to be just extrapolating and giving you the carbon credits. Now, the whole purpose of this carbon credit gets defeated when you look at all these different processes that are being formed, right? Which means we are going to get a very cheap wine over there. The carbon credit that we get is absolutely like the wine that you get in your corner store, like a $5 wine, a £5 wine. Yeah. Yes, you might want to drink it when you're out for a picnic, but when you are actually in a serious meal and having a business discussion, you might want to have the nice wine. But where do you get the nice wine from? Mm. Right. So my concept is, to be able to get the nice wine, we have to get the nice grape, which means to be able to get the nice environmental carbon credit, we have to get the nice data. To be able to get the nice data, you have to make sure that the data comes in from non-biased IoT sensors. And these non-biased IoT sensors would get you the nice grape that you can preserve and protect in a blockchain. And when you preserve and protect in a blockchain, then that grape, that's where the future value aspect was coming in. That grape, which would give me a nice wine in the future, becomes an asset. Because now I can extrapolate and say, hey, I'm going to get a very nice wine out of this grape. Are you willing to underwrite this? I'm going to tokenize this and get some liquidity out of it. That's the whole construct.
Jack's favorite wine is cheap. He refuses to spend more than like £5 on a bottle of wine. So it's gone over his head. But I appreciate the finer things. We've been talking about tokenized data and how to make data more valuable. And you have good data and bad data. And, you know, one of the classic kind of sayings around blockchain is garbage in, garbage out, right? That kind of thing. And I'm surprised it's taken us so long to talk about IoT, because we, you know, previously when you were on the show, we talked about supply chains and blockchain and Web3, and IoT was a big part of that. You know, just-in-time delivery, IoT devices, all this kind of stuff. And when we talk about quality of data, the blockchain itself doesn't necessarily, in my understanding, is the blockchain itself doesn't necessarily guarantee quality data. It just guarantees that the data hasn't changed, for example. And, you know, in the example we were talking about earlier, when we were talking about healthcare data, well, you probably want your healthcare data signed off by a doctor, but you don't want that to be in the public domain shared across blockchain. So we have all these very intelligent ways to do that, where you can obfuscate the data, hash it, confuse it, all these kind of terms for that, and then sign across that, and then just prove that that data relates to it. But how does the IoT part fit into this paradigm of, you know, quality data maintained through blockchain?
So I feel it's not only IoT. I think IoT, AI, and blockchain, their interplay is what is going to get us the high quality, right? So essentially, IoT is my source. So, you know, actually, there's one thing that when we're talking about trust, which blockchain is getting us, is, you know, how is my trust going to be scalable, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be, let's start from like a step-by-step approach. Yeah, it could be, oh, I know Alec. Alec is a really nice guy. Alec is going to go and do the readings for me. Yeah. And he signs off with those readings. And then we put that reading into a database. Oh, by the way, this reading was collected by Alec. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now I know Alec. So essentially I say thumbs up to the data that you put in, because you want to give me really nice data. But the person who works along with me doesn't know Alec. And I'll have to go and explain to him, hey, Alec is a nice guy. Maybe he trusts me, so that trust might go away, but might be transferred. But imagine trying to scale this up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be a problem, right? Mm-hmm. So I have to have something else. So I will probably take a picture of Alec taking that data, mm-hmm. right? And then use that picture as a measure. Say, hey, this is Alec, and you know, this is geofenced and whatever. And this picture has the latitude, longitude over there. So that would be my next level. Yeah. Now, again, this is not a very scalable thing when it comes to, this might be a good idea when it comes to something which is of high value, but Alec doesn't come in for cheap, right? He's an expensive resource. So if I have to scale this up, if I have to make sure that this trust is scalable yet inexpensive, I have to do innovations in IoT. It's as simple as that. And I mean, then again, the question would be, how do we trust the IoT, right? Whether the IoT is functioning the way it should function. So we can do triangulation of data. We can use artificial intelligence. So just a simple few things that people have done in the past with IoT. And this is just solar data. So with solar, you are able to compute the amount of carbon footprint that you're reducing. Yeah. But then you could triangulate that with the amount of time sun was, that place had sun over the year, and see, hey, this day it was raining here. How did you get solar data? So that way, you could make sure that the technology is there. So IoT, AI, blockchain, all these three would actually increase the value of the grape that we are talking about.
That's a really good comparison. I never thought about having like different data sources that kind of enrich the data set, but also contrast and make sure it's kind of like you're operating like in a blockchain kind of mindset of decentralized, and everyone's working together, but also independently and against one another. So in that example, to simplify, you've got multiple data sets that are all being collected by independent IoT devices. They're all being pulled together, and you're having this kind of AI algorithm in between that's assessing the data and applying some kind of reasoning to be like, oh yeah, this IoT cannot have been producing this many carbon credits because it was dark at this time. And the blockchain angle, again, is just to log that data, create a unique identifier, just prove what's happened, and then create a degree of liquidity to, you know, change that around.
That's so true. That's true.
Okay, that's a really interesting example. I was trying to think about how this relates to, say, autonomous vehicles, where you have the intelligence data being collected, but when they crash, what happens there? Like, do we trust the Tesla vehicle to say, you know, this is the reason they crashed and update the entire system? Like, this is like a kind of pressing issue, I guess, in the States where you are right now, where people, you know, the data suggests that Tesla are far better at, you know, not having crashes and being safe and all this kind of stuff. But there's a real trust paradigm where people can't get over that barrier of not trusting that, you know, all the Teslas don't get binned because one Tesla had a car crash.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, definitely I understand your analogy when you talk about autonomous vehicles. But, you know, the scale of trust also has to be normalized by the impact on your life. Right. I think, you know, if I have a scale of trust, I won't kind of trust an autonomous artificial intelligent tool to be able to do my kidney stone surgery. Let's put it that way. Right. I mean, as much as it sounds fancy, and maybe we'll see it in our lifetimes, but you know, you will be a bit worried. Yeah, you still want a person driving the tool. Suppose it goes wrong on you. Yeah, but you know, when it comes time to things which have impact, which does matter to us, but not something which is going to impact on, is going to kill us, then maybe the technology is something that we would accept in many ways. Yeah. I've seen people talking about autopilot mode in Tesla and saying, oh, it's so cool. It's like, okay, are you going to drive autopilot all the time? No, only when I'm in long drives. Okay, what is the difference there? Oh, because it's a clear day. Some people have all kinds of information, yeah, whether right or wrong, who knows. It says, oh, when it's nice, bright, and it's not raining, that's the best day to go autopilot. I said, okay, fine. You know what? That's your way of looking at things. That they think that is the day when, you know, autopilot works best. They must have read things that when it rains, it's difficult for the autopilot to detect the lines on the road. But autopilot can go wrong anytime, right? So does autonomous vehicle can go wrong anytime, and it can kill people, right? But carbon credit, it's not going to kill people. Right. And IoT. So I feel that normalization needs to be done before we start kind of scaling the trust to something which is going to be of high impact to us. In my opinion.
This is like really interesting because, like, yeah, I guess autonomous vehicles, and I know this is not what we got you here to talk about, but now we're talking about it, I'm quite interested to get your opinion on it. Because, like, if you look at, say, the data, it says it's much safer on average than the average person, but then every individual is like, no, I am the exception to the rule. I personally am far safer than any autonomous vehicle. What is your, like, attitude to this? Do you think that, like, they are safe? Do you think it's the future? Is it inevitable? But also, do you trust in the data themselves? And it's kind of, the relation here is about trust in data, right?
It is. And I mean, if you ask me, I'm always an early adopter to things. So I might not, I might not be the right person to kind of give an opinion on this, but I'll give my personal opinion. I'm a big supporter of autonomous transportation for a multitude of reasons, because, you know, I'm designing optimal autonomous transportations where we could have shared transportation for a community and would reduce our carbon footprint, right? So I definitely believe in that piece. I definitely believe that that's going to happen. I believe that that's happening. I mean, there are so many solutions which are out there which are quite safe, better than, and as humans, we don't know when we'll make a mistake, right? From an AI system, there could be unique permutation combination. Mathematically, yes, there could be a combination that, you know, it might not be able to respond, or there might be a weird kind of a response to something. But that happens with humans as well. So, I mean, it's just, if it's just a machine, why are we going to be like, you know, why do we have a bias, right? Why do we think people are better than machine? But yeah, I mean, I did mention that, yes, I would love to have a doctor at the other end doing a surgery for me. Yeah. I mean, on introspection, a doctor can also make a mistake. We always hear about surgeons making a mistake and people kind of suffering because of that mistake. But then you can go and hold that doctor. But over here, you don't have an AI engine to hold accountable to, right? Whom are you going to talk to? So these are some, and as we evolve and as, you know, this gets more and more embedded in our day-to-day life, I think maybe you'll start accepting everything.
Yeah, it's like it gets into the realm of like philosophy at the end of the day. It's like we want someone to be accountable, and like maybe we can't necessarily empathize and fully trust in something we don't understand. I get my doctor. I know they're, you know, 40 years old. They've done this many, many times. And if they screwed up, they wouldn't be a doctor. Whereas an AI, even if it's necessarily safer, we don't really understand like how it goes wrong. And you say, okay, this AI has made 2 million mistakes, but it's far safer than a human. But you're still like, well, it's made 2 million mistakes. Am I one of those mistakes? Yeah, it's a tricky one, but I think it's something that we are seeing being addressed more and more. And the conversation is coming up as like, you know, Tesla's recently announced all their new humanoid robots and all their new autonomous vehicles without drivers, without taxi drivers, even seats and steering wheels. And this conversation is coming up more and more where it's safer, but people have a problem with deploying them and using them personally. I've actually used some of them and I think they're incredible. But yeah, there's still like a bit of weirdness the first time you jump in a car without a driver.
Yeah, it's just because, you know, I was in a summit last week and then somebody talked about the problem that the mechanics are going to have, right, with electric cars, because there's no longer an engine, right? So this whole paradigm has shifted. The transportation, the idea was that you're going to look for a like a engine which has a piston and, you know, you have to do oil change. What about oil change with electric cars, right? So, I mean, the things that we grew up with, when they change, it takes some time for people to kind of adapt. But technology for people, a technology is only for things that we have seen in our lifetime come in, right? Like, you know, like cell phone was introduced after we were born, after I was born at least. So it's a technology for me, but it's not a technology for my kids, right? For them, it's just a phone.
It's like a commodity or something.
Exactly. So artificial intelligence is also going to be something like that. When you have kids who are 1 year old start talking to AI engines and they have their own personal AI buddies or whatever, then they will probably take this like, okay, what's the problem here, right?
Yeah,
I mean, will see the human race also evolve.
When it's, they say it's, you know, when it's suitably advanced, it appears like magic, right? You don't have to worry anymore. I'm interested that, you know, Alex just used the word commodity. One of the themes I'm picking out here, and stop me if I'm wrong, but I think when we're talking about data tokenization, I'm seeing kind of two different buckets. So one being on the personal, individual, human being side of things and tokenizing your personal data. And on the other is kind of everything else. It's more like the industrial, supply chain, IoT type data. And AI can feed into both of those buckets, right? You can use them to train AI for different purposes. Now, I'm interested in getting out of the abstract, the pure abstract. Where do you see the most promise for these things? Because I know on the human kind of personal data side, people like Tim Berners-Lee obviously have been working on how you manage that better. I'm not necessarily sure from a tokenization perspective, but with his kind of company and product Solid, they're trying to do that. And I know you know, you've mentioned in the past things like Algorand as being something like a digital seller for your data. But I mentioned, where are you seeing the actual on the ground progress towards everything you've been talking about so far? And how far do you think we've got to go to actually, you know, get these into the hands of real users and people?
Yeah. See, when it comes to analytics, data is way, I mean, out there. Like, you know, if we talk about the Web2 world of data and analytics. But when it comes to the Web3 aspect, as of now, I think identity as a data is something that we are still grappling with. We have not actually cracked that very well, right? And how can that identity as a data transform our lives? Simple things, right? You want to go to a club when you are 20, how many, I don't know, in UK, 21 years old, right?
I think it's 18, but yeah.
18, okay. In Quebec, it was 17, so 17, 18, 21, okay. 18, okay. Now, you want to go to a club, you're 21 years old, 18 years old rather, you have to show them your ID, yeah? The person at the front desk has a glass where he can take, he or she can take a picture of your ID, yeah? Now, your ID can easily be duplicated. We all know how IDs are being duplicated, how, you know, you can just change a picture and print an ID and 17-year-olds are getting into clubs, yeah? What if I have an identity system where I just give you a token that you are 18 plus, right? I'm not showing any personal information to anyone over here. I'm just giving you a simple example, right? Have we figured that out yet? Do we have that yet? Right? In fact, all developed countries, if you remember the time during COVID, we had to carry our COVID vaccination cards on us. Why did we have to carry those vaccination cards? If we had received two tokens or one token that we've been vaccinated, that was good enough, no? But how could we issue that in a Web2 system, right? But if it was a Web3 system through which it was issued, right? So as of now, when it comes to talking about data and talk about how things are going on, I think identity is still a work in process for me. And that is where most of the things, once that gets grounded, then most of the things would start kind of wrapping around really fast. Okay. And also applications around identity. Like, you know, I do some kind of a social service. My kids do some kind of service, yeah? They have some service hours. They go from their school community service here and there. They go to the beach. They clean the beach. They get a certificate, right? Who's verified that? There's a person in the beach can be my drinking buddy. And I say, hey, I need like 10 certificates for my kid. The person, I'm not saying I'm going to do that, but suppose, yeah? There is no verification of anything of that sort, yeah? I feel that kind of data, that quality of information is going to start coming in more and more when we go more decentralized. Centralized systems are prone to manipulation. Centralized systems, as much as we have grown up with centralized systems, we all know centralized systems have one person who can make that change for you, can add the data. Decentralized systems are much more trustworthy, but we don't have the mechanisms to be able to put them into play. Yeah. And that's what I think is the key piece over here. How can we scale the trust? What are the mechanisms that we have to be able to collect data in a decentralized manner and scale it? And scale it to a level where it is going to start impacting our lives, start giving us high quality wine in the context of, you know.
That's the end goal for you, isn't it? Getting high quality wine.
Instead of the low quality wine that we are getting as of now. Or maybe, you know, we think we are drinking wine, but it is just some kind of a red colored wine.
Why is this taking so long though? I feel like people have been talking about like the decentralized identity solution for like honestly 10 years now. What's the big holdup with this kind of stuff, do you think?
The biggest holdup for this is that once you have issuers, you have to have verifiers also. Okay. So we can go and, I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday who was talking about, yes, you made a great solution with decentralized identity, but who's going to accept that? And that's a very valid point, right? I create an identity for financial inclusion for a person, right? If I go to a bank and say, hey, I have a whole identity for this person, their whole identity journey is there, will you accept that? They're like, I don't have the mechanism to be able to study that. I still need a printout where everything needs to be attested and is submitted to me. Right. So if we have an identity, we have to have a consumer. Right. I'll give you one simple example of identity and consumer. Maybe that's not in the Web3 paradigm, but it is a system which was built, which is an Aadhaar system in India. Okay. If you look at the Aadhaar system in India, it's magical. Okay, it just tells you that if I tell you that I'm Nikhil Verma, you can put me in front of a small machine and say, this person is saying is Nikhil Verma, is he Nikhil Verma? Mm-hmm. And it'll give you a yes or a no answer, nothing more. Yeah. So you see, now verification, which is the key one, know your customer, KYC, becomes super easy. Back in those days, it took so much time for me to just tell them I am who I am. Yeah. Now it takes them, they just need an interface, my fingerprint, and off you go. Yeah. Right? So we have to have those kind of mechanisms put into play. And this is, you know, I was looking at diffusion models. This has to come in from two places. One, places where technology, we are looking at bringing in efficiencies, bringing in more inclusion. Other, by policy. Mm-hmm. Right? Both directions, when this convergence happens, we will start getting to see things.
Yeah, that's a really good point, I think, for us to close the show out with, because we've been talking again a lot in the abstract, and I think I like that you highlighted that last use case around KYC as not being necessarily, you know, in the Web3 paradigm completely. It's something, this whole thing we're talking about with data tokenization does really transcend Web3, and as you outlined, there's lots of good reasons for going towards this model, and the incentives, you know, to improve incentives for both companies and individuals. I think there's lots of good things we can do there, but there's also lots of things that need to happen in order to realize that vision, right? It's very much still at the conceptual experimental stage, although we are seeing some green roots in Web3, I think, leading this, but it's one to keep an eye on for the future. I think it's going to take a long time to get there. But yeah, thank you so much, Nikhil, for giving us such a really good introduction to this topic. And I'm sure we'll have you on again in the future to go into more details potentially. But yeah, thank you for your time. And to those listening, wherever you may be, join us next time to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.